Depending on where you live, you may have access to seeds for just the basic flowers and vegetables that are for sale in maybe the local hardware store or the garden center. And because gardening trends change sort of just like in fashion, even if seeds were available one year for a favorite variety, they may not be there the next time you want to buy them. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk. It may seem daunting. Seed saving and collecting is a fun way, though, to greatly expand the variety and number of plants in your garden. And we'll talk about that with a couple of great guests today. Barb Larson, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Kenosha County. She has a wealth of information to share. Always happy to have her join us on Garden Talk. Barb, great to see you.
I'm very happy to be back.
Well, and here we're welcoming a new person, Christy Marsden, who is a horticulture educator with UW Extension in Rock County. And she used to work with Seed Savers Exchange in Decorah, Iowa. Christy, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Looking forward to it because we've had a lot of questions over time. Practically every show you get a question relating to seeds and saving seeds. So it's great to have you along with the kind of background you have. Why might we want to save seeds? What would be a good reason?
So for me personally, I like to save seeds because there are particular varieties that are no longer commercially available or are hard to find and that have really unique and different stories that that saving that seed makes sure that I have that seed from one or that plant variety from one season to the next. Also is a way to save money. So that way I don't have to buy new seed every year because I've saved it from the previous year. And then it also helps preserve the genetic diversity of this vast amount of awesome plants we have out there that, you know, the general trends are is that you just have a few really popular tomatoes, but there are so many cool tomatoes out there that may get lost if people don't save them and share them.
Yeah.
And those are some reasons, yeah.
There's one that I kind of missed. I've been looking for a tomato, a yellow tomato, Golden Boy, that I really liked a lot when I raised. And now I can't find it, of course, anywhere. So
save the seeds when you find it, and then you'll have it for years to come.
I'm sure it's still out there somewhere. Are there plants that we really shouldn't try to save seed from?
Corn is really difficult when it comes to saving seeds, and especially living in the Midwest where you're growing a lot of corn. So that's something to think about. And then it just depends on the particular variety. Some are a lot more difficult, like broccoli and cauliflower, and those coal crops are really difficult just because of a lot of different factors of how they pollinate, how they share pollen, and how they grow. So some of those might be a little more challenging for the homeowner.
I also suggest that people don't save from hybrids, or that's a little bit of a problem because usually what happens is you don't get the same as the parent plant. So it's kind of fun to see what you get from that, but you don't always get it back.
Yeah,
so
you're not going to get the same thing.
Yeah, generally we want to look at those older varieties or there's heirloom types of varieties.
And pretty much any type of, what types of plants would normally be most likely to save?
So you want to focus on open pollinated, which just means that there's a free flow, and that's the heirlooms. Really easy ones and good starter ones are things like lettuce. You can do tomatoes, beans, some of those easy garden crops that we're already pretty familiar with.
And genetic quality, need to worry about that at all when you're trying to save seed? I assume so.
A lot of the techniques for saving seeds are to prevent cross-pollination, and it just comes with knowledge. So the publication that is available talks about a lot of the different things just to keep in mind to prevent that cross-pollination, to make sure that the genetics are there. It's like with when you're collecting seed from beans don't generally cross-pollinate, so that's a little easier. You might just need 5 to 10 plants, depending, whereas something that is easily cross-pollinated, like peppers, you'd have to keep different things in mind, like make sure you didn't have two different kinds of peppers in your garden, or if you did, cover the peppers that you want to save, to different things like that, and just to prevent that cross-pollination to make sure those genetics are true.
Are true, sure. We've got callers online with actually some questions about seeds, so we will go to those phones right now. You can join us, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234 with your questions on Garden Talk. Marion in Windsor, thank you for calling. Hi.
Yeah, I'm wondering how to save tomato seeds. I already do beans and some flowers and that kind of thing, but tomato seeds, I dried some, but they're also sticky.
Yeah. You
know, and I think there's probably a better way.
Well, Christy's excited to answer the question.
I am. I love saving seeds from tomatoes. So what you'll do with tomatoes is you'll get your market mature, just they're ready to eat tomatoes, and you'll squeeze out all the inside juices. So you know how the seed has that gelatin coat and all that kind of stuff. And you could put it in a cup, and you could put a little bit of water depending on the liquid level with all that gooey insides. And what you actually do is you're going to put it on the counter and just let it ferment for a few days. And what that does is it eats away all that fermentation at that gelatinous seed coating, all that stickiness. And so that goes away. All of your seeds then will kind of fall to the bottom. So in 1 or 2 days, what you can do is you can clean off the seeds. They'll be nice and non-sticky. Put them out to dry, and then you'll have saved tomato seeds.
Oh, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And that's pretty easy.
Yeah.
Get right down to it.
Yeah, it's kind of fun, too.
Julia in Spooner, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I've always heard that you're not supposed to save to hybrid seeds, but yet I do see seeds for various cultivars, like the Echinacea power, was it powwow berry plant. So I'm always wondering how it is that some cultivars apparently do come true from seed.
A hybrid, often those are seed produced, but it could be that it's a controlled cross. So it's only a certain mother plant and a certain father plant. So they only get the pollen from one plant, and then it has to be pollinate another certain one, and that's how they get those specific hybrids. Sometimes they're a little more open, but you know, Christy mentioned they open pollinization, meaning that it doesn't make any difference who pollinates who, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that it comes true. In other words, the desirable characteristics continue on from that. So, yeah, we do have hybrids that are, in fact, a lot of them that are seed produced, but there is that control in there.
Mm-hmm.
So then if you grow the seeds from your own plants, then you're probably not going to get exactly what you had, even if they were
right,
started from seed.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, thanks.
Now, that doesn't mean it's not fun to do.
Yeah.
Just as long as you know that it may be not be identical to what your original plant was.
Thank.
And is there any way other than just trying them how to tell?
Nope. That's the fun part of gardening.
Okay. No way.
Thank you.
Thanks, Julie. Thanks a lot for calling. You can join in, too. Maybe you have a question for our guest today. Is your garden pretty much done for the season? Or do you still have some things growing? What about saving seeds? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mehler Show. And certainly love to hear from you. I'm telling you, I have, I don't know how many tomato plants. I have a lot of tomato plants, and they're all just packed with green tomatoes yet. We've gotten a lot of tomatoes off, but I'm looking at these green tomatoes and thinking, oh, man, I still want more.
Well, they're green tomato pie, things.
We did talk about
salsa,
that.
Salsa, I think.
Yeah.
You can also, and certainly I'm not a food. But you can wrap the tomatoes, if you've got a frost, take them off, wrap them in like newspaper, mm-hmm. and that will help them to ripen. So you can sometimes get a few that way, mm-hmm. too. And tomatoes actually will tolerate light frost. They're not necessarily the ones that'll go down first. Things like green beans and some of the other things will go first.
And cover them in a sheet or something like that mm-hmm. if you know mm-hmm. a frost is coming, to try to help it.
Help it.
Or help all those green tomatoes ripen in time. But it's also this warm weather that mm-hmm. we've been having will kind of help a little bit. But I don't know. Hopefully.
somebody was telling me, I forget who now, that once the tomato starts to turn a little, you can bring it inside where it's warmer and consistently mm-hmm. warmer. Mm-hmm. And it'll probably ripen better than if you just leave it out on the plant.
Yeah. And you know, wrapping it in newspaper is the same idea as when you put the apple or banana in the bag with something and you want to ripen the fruit. It's because that ethylene gas helps to be release it and then it helps to ripen it.
Yeah,
so.
I used to have, back in the day, a long time ago, I had a fruit ripening bowl.
Yes.
One of these big old plastic, remember yep. those? And with a cover on and some holes on the top, I have no idea whatever happened to that fruit ripening bowl. But
yeah, I don't think you need
lost,
a special one.
Just put it in paper
lost
bag.
In a move somewhere along the line. I don't know which move, but it's long gone. But actually, if I that
yeah,
that,
it would work.
That
sure.
would work, but
sure.
you know, so will a bag.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
A bag will not cost as much as my fruit ripening bowl.
No,
probably not. No.
Oh, man. John in Waukesha, your turn. Hi, John.
Hello.
Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I'm wondering if I have planted seeds for blue corn plants and seeds for red corn plants in the same plot, am I going to get purple corn?
Oh, I don't know for
Ooh.
Sure, but you could potentially... Corn is really neat in that most varieties, if there's any kind of cross-pollination, you won't be able to tell within the first year. But because the corn cob, when you're looking at the corn, each kernel is a seed, you're gonna automatically see if there's cross-pollination that first year. It's one of the few vegetable varieties, which is neat to do that. So I'm not really sure how the genetics work in that, but you can try it and let me know.
Yeah.
Okay, I will.
Yeah, give it a try. Oh, you get some white corn in there, too. You have red, white, and blue.
Yeah. Some people have done
patriotic
that.
Patriotic corn.
Yeah.
There we go. Oh, Aaron in Richland Center. Hi.
Hi. I have a large rose bush out in front of my house.
Yeah.
And I've never seen this before, but it has no roses left on it, but it has one standalone red, bulbous, radish-type shaped like bulb on it, and like almost like a fruit. Could you tell me what that is, and should I save it or replant it?
Well, without having a little more information, I'm thinking it's, well, and I see the original that you put in, maybe a tomato-like or something like that. I'm wondering if it's one of the nightshades, which is a pretty common weed that we have. So, no, you don't want to propagate that. But don't save any of that, and definitely don't eat anything like that until you have it definitively identified. So you could take it into your county extension office or take photos and have them identify it that way.
But this is right on the rose bush itself or part of the rose bush?
Oh, I'm sorry. Maybe I misunderstood.
It could be a rose hip or something.
It's probably, it could be a rose hip. I misunderstood then.
Yeah.
Is it on the bush?
Yeah, it's growing right out of the bush.
Okay, I'm sorry. That was out of the bush made me think it was growing through it. So that was my mind. So yeah, that's a rose hip. So you can propagate that. Christy, you want to?
The way I know that roses are generally propagated is by clonal propagation or just by the wood. So I don't actually know about the seeds of that. I'd look into it before you save seeds and try to grow it from that, because most people do do roses by grafting from one variety to the next. And then, so I don't really know.
Yeah, especially the what I would call we do have some native roses, and those certainly could be seed propagated. So it depends on what kind of rose you have to begin with. And roses are done like Christy described for the tomatoes, where they're crushed and then put in water and then they ferment and then the seeds drop to the ground or drop to the bottom of the bowl or the cup, and then you can take them off and dry them. But if it's a, you know, things like a hybrid tea or a Floribunda or some of those roses are all grafted. So you could get viable seed off of it, but this is another one where it might be really interesting to see what kind of thing you got out of it. But certainly you could do it that way. It's just not the typical way for roses.
So should I research it, or should I cut it off and put it in a bag?
I think you can cut it off. You can get the seeds out of it and try it if you want. You know, some of this gets into how much do you want to try and experiment yourself and see what happens.
Sure.
Some people love to do that kind of thing and just kind of experiment with things. And others want, no, I'd rather really know what I'm getting and I don't want to mess around with it. So, it's your individual preference.
Be fun to do, though.
Yeah.
Give it a shot.
It would be.
Thanks, Aaron. Thank you very much for calling. We are talking about all kinds of things relating to the fall garden, including saving seeds, with our two guests, Barb Larson and Christy Marsden, both UW Extension horticulture educators. Barb's out of Kenosha County. Christy's out of Rock County. I'm Larry Mueller. Robin Cherry, our on-air producer here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. UW Extension horticulture educators Barb Larson and Christy Marsden, our guests today. Larry Mueller here. Thank you so much for listening in. Call us with your question at 800-642-1234. Let's turn to Greg in Milwaukee next. Greg, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Love your show. I don't get to listen to it every time, but I absolutely love it. You gave me some great ideas. And especially one that I picked up, I think it was back in April, about straw bale gardening.
Yeah.
I got a late start on that because I ended up taking the book on vacation with me, and I didn't get back till May. So it didn't propagate as well as I would have liked, but I haven't given up because I did get some wonderful spaghetti squash out of it, some wonderful cucumbers, some wonderful basil. But that was only about the third of the plants. So, but my question is, and since I'm kind of a novice gardener, can I take the straw bales now and turn? And I've never composted before.
Yeah.
Can I use them as in a compost pile, or do I just need to?
I think it'd be great compost, yep. Don't you, Barb?
Yeah, absolutely. This is, you want to put this in as part of the basis of your compost pile. It would be a great way to start it. In fact, for straw bale gardening to be successful, you're actually composting within that straw bale. It has to start to decompose in order for plants to live in there. So we have several brand new publications from UW Extension Publications, thelearningstore.uwex.edu, on composting. So one brand new one on how to compost, and then several on different compost bins and other kinds of holding things for it. So
Greg, I tried it at home. I wanted to try it because the show we did on it was so much fun and so kind of exciting, and got enthused about it. And we took a bale. I just one bale, a long bale, straw bale. I put three tomato plants on it on the top, and then I had eggplant and some herbs coming out of the side. And we just had a great eggplant parmesan roast the other night.
I'm jealous.
and the tomatoes were wonderful. We got a late start too, so I have a lot of tomatoes that. I think if we'd gotten those plants in a couple weeks earlier, we'd have been a lot better off.
Yeah.
But no,
I also no
tomato diseases, no blossom end rot. Which is something I had in other circumstances when I've had tomatoes growing out of big pots and so forth.
It would probably stay moist better, or you're just keeping it well watered better, which is a problem with it.
Yeah. So really enjoyed it.
Good.
You can tell I was a city boy because since I got the late start, the only place I could find straw bales were at a local major retail garden outlet, and they were the decorative kind, but I was determined to get this thing started.
Okay, well, that's great.
Well, good for you, and you and I both have to get an earlier start next year.
Yes, I'm driving up to Clintonville to a local farmer to get my bales for next year.
Okay, well, and welcome to gardening. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Well, yeah, you know, part of that, just as an aside before we go on with the straw bale gardening, you have to sort of water and set those bales up about 10 days to 2 weeks ahead of time before you. I mean, you're watering them and getting them. And probably a little fertilizer in there, as I recall.
Yeah, you absolutely would have to put that in because otherwise straw is all there's really nothing. Not any nutrients or much in there. Yeah. So you really, if you're going to do straw bale gardening, you've got to follow those directions. And what happens is that straw and the other stuff you add in there starts to decompose. Yeah. And so you're actually making compost in a bale.
There are other ways probably that
might be done. which I fixed a few years back with potassium.
What's interesting if it is late blight, and you could take a sample to the extension office and have them just double check it. But
yeah, I've done that.
Okay, and they've identified it as late blight.
No, they're processing it right now.
Okay, all right.
The question I have is, I was told by somebody from their temporary station here in Racine County to take the vines and burn them.
Yeah. You need to either burn them or bury them.
Oh, you can bury them.
Yep. Get them down a foot or so because you don't want to and you want to stay away from it. I've also had with late blight where people will, and actually what's what I had to do with mine several years ago, is actually put them in black plastic garbage bags and then get rid of them that way too. You definitely don't want them around.
No.
My primary question is, the vine thing, I have a mulcher. I was going to grind them up and then put them in a separate compost pile. But if I can bury them, that would be fine.
Yeah, don't put them in your compost, and you want to make sure that you pick up every single fruit and everything.
Yep. That was my question. I have what appear, I'm looking at them right now, and it looks like I need a front end loader to take care of what's laying on the ground.
Yeah. With 50 plants, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yes, and because almost everything went bad.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I got very few fruit. On the other hand, on the other end of my garden, I put a little garden up with five plants for my little friend next door who likes to come and steal my tomatoes, so I gave him his own little garden. His tomatoes are doing great.
Oh.
So and go back and steal your own tomatoes.
Yeah.
What's ironic is when they started out, his got a little brown on the bottom, and he got stunted. And mine were almost as tall as me. They were just growing great. So all of a sudden, mine started getting a problem, and his started taking off. Well, he's got he got more fruit off five plants than I got out of 50.
Oh.
So and that's just one end of the garden to the next. I don't know if it's prevailing winds or what the deal is there, but I do rotate every year.
Okay, good.
This crop here, I noticed I had something coming on last year, and this crop here, it's a slight slope, and it's downhill from last year. Is it possible the water carried the virus or whatever it is down to this location?
No, it's fungal borne. This is not one of the water ones.
It blows in, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it's one that's an airborne. But we do know that the main way it overwinters is in fruits and other debris from infected tomatoes. So that's why it's really important that you do a really good cleanup. And I know it probably won't make you feel any better, but my colleague Patty Nagai in Racine County had the same thing happen with her entire demonstration garden at the food bank. So they had to take all of their tomatoes out, too. They lost the entire crop.
Yeah.
Same thing. So
all of this fruit has to be moved out of this location?
Yep.
Can I just leave it there and rotate?
No.
It'll spread.
It'll spread and it'll stay.
Yep. Yeah. That's the source of reinfection.
Bobcat. I suppose maybe I can borrow that.
Yeah.
Get her down a foot.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't want to leave any of that stuff. And that's why I'm concerned about using something like a bobcat, because you're going to smash those fruit and leave pieces.
Oh, yeah.
So I know it's much higher amount of work, but you really need to, I would think, almost hand clean up.
Oh, I would. Yeah, I was thinking use the bobcat
and
to dig
scrape
the hole.
Down.
To dig the hole.
To dig the hole. Okay. Yep.
Yeah.
I figure why go down a foot when you go down 3 feet?
That's
okay.
Yeah,
that's the goal here. But I'll probably step on some stuff in the process. But what about the grinding of the, I bought a mulching device that worked really good on all my other vine stuff. And would it be okay to grind this stuff up in it's a chipper shredder type dealie that really works good on vegetation? Can I make a pile of that and let it spread it out, let it dry, and burn it? Would that work?
I'd be afraid of getting contamination on your chipper and then spreading it to other things that you might potentially keep.
Okay.
Yeah.
You'd be taking a blowtorch to your chipper afterwards to burn
it
off.
There's no chemical
I mean, you'd have to really sanitize it.
Yeah, I think it'd be tough to sanitize a chipper.
Yeah.
Is there any chemicals that will work on this? If I looked it up, there's some kind of copper stuff I bought from a local store to keep my garden, from having any harsh chemicals. And the copper thing, by the time one quarter of my garden caught, I went around and I looked, and everything had signs of it.
Yeah,
and it was too late, so everything got wiped out.
Copper fungicide is the one that's recommended for home growers for late blight. As is typical of most fungicides, they're preventative.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to do it.
Harsher than that? Because I'm trying to stay organic, but this is wiping out a whole crop is pretty significant to me.
No, the other ones that I know of off the top of my head are ones that are generally not available to home growers.
Mm-hmm.
And you will, we do have a couple of very good fact sheets on late blight.
Mm-hmm.
So if you sent your sample to the extension office or the satellite extension office, they'll get you those fact sheets, or you can even go online on one of our websites and get it. And the recommendations are all there.
Go to the Learning Store, UW.
Either Learning Store or the hort.uwex.edu. That has the short fact sheets.
There you go, Mike. Good luck. Sorry.
Sorry about it. Yeah.
Sue in River Falls. Thank you for calling. Hi. What's on your mind?
Would I be able to save the seed from a Lord Baltimore hardy hibiscus and also my heavenly blue morning glories?
So I'm not sure about the hibiscus, but I know about the morning glories you could for sure. I have no idea about the hibiscus.
First of all, it's one of those pretty highly hybridized variety.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking that... even if it had viable seed, that's another one that probably will not come back. It won't be a Lord Baltimore again.
No, it might be something cool and different, but
yeah. But you want to talk about morning glories? How you save those?
Morning glories, I think they produce the seed pod that you can just save. So as long as you don't have, as long as your neighbors don't have a different morning glory or anything like that, and as long as the morning glory you grew is not a hybrid, usually in the seed catalog it'll have F1 or something like that next to its name.
What does F1 mean?
It just means that's kind of a way that the seed companies label something as hybrid. It's just the first generation of a cross. So if it's not a hybrid, then you can totally save them.
And I know they easily propagate because I've had problems with morning glories that self-seed.
Yes, yeah.
So, they may do it without you doing anything at all about it.
Mm-hmm.
You may have lots of morning glories next year.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Sue, for calling. And Vi and Shano, hi.
Hello. It's a beautiful day today.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
I have a little tip about saving if you have a lot of tomatoes. Years ago, we lived on a farmette, and we had so many tomatoes. And we took the green ones, spread newspaper on the basement floor, and then put the tomatoes down and covered them with newspaper also. About 3 layers, maybe 4. And we had almost had tomatoes all winter.
Oh, wow. Good for you.
And we had a few rotten ones, that rotted, but most of them came through.
Oh.
Well, I might be just trying that out, Vi.
Yeah.
I've got tons of green tomatoes. I might just try it just to experiment to see what happens.
You must have one of those good, cool basements because most people, most of our basements, we can't do that anymore.
Yeah.
You can try it.
Try it.
We're going to give it a shot, Vi. Thanks. Thanks a lot for calling. By the way, you can join in, too, with your questions or comments. Call us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. We actually finally have some open lines again, so we can get you on pretty quickly if you call. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page. I have to check the page out and see if we've got anything here. That's at the Larry Mueller Show. Click there. If you got a photo, garden photo. Love to see that, too. Let's go to Christian and Toma next. Hi, Christian.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
What?
Well,
I was wondering how to save carrot seeds.
Oh, all right. So carrot seeds.
Yeah, carrots are a bit tricky. What's unique about carrots is that they're a biennial, which means that they need two seasons to grow seed. So what you're eating when you eat a carrot is the root. And if you eat the root, that means there's no plant for the following year to produce any kind of flowers or seeds. So what you have to do in Wisconsin, because it's cold, is you have to dig up the carrots, store them in your basement or someplace for them to be overwintered. That's slightly cold, but not going to be freezing, so it doesn't injure the roots. And then in the spring, you plant them back into the ground, so then that way they put up a flower stalk. And then once they flower, they'll create seeds. One of the other tricky things, though, about carrots is that I don't know if you're familiar with the weed Queen's Anne's lace, but the carrots will freely cross-pollinate with Queen's Anne's lace, and Queen's Anne's lace is really prevalent and hard to get rid of. And so if it's anywhere within a mile or two of the carrots that you're trying to save, you're probably going to get some cross-pollination that'll produce some really unflavorable carrots.
So. You're not going to like
Queen Anne's lace carrots.
Yeah, they're not going to taste very good. So,
it's a bit of work, Christian, and it may be a bit of a problem.
Yeah, and you need a lot of carrots to get them to actually cross-pollinate enough to produce viable seeds. So that's one of the trickier ones to save seeds. But it can be done.
Yeah, it could be done, but...
You know, that comes down to there's some things that are fun to do, but maybe it's fun, but it doesn't necessarily make sense to do. Yeah. So I think we do a lot of those things, which are fine.
Yeah. It kind of reminds me of the book I got on growing mushrooms. That the one of the instructions was to have some elephant manure.
Which
I didn't happen to have any.
I don't even know what you did that.
And the zoo didn't have an elephant, so I was I decided right then and there I wasn't going to do the mushrooms, at least the ones from that book. Oh, thanks, Christian.
Yep.
Lauren Marinette, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Oh, I just had a comment on the lady who had called about the tomatoes and storing them green.
Yeah.
We've done this also for years, but we would wrap them each individually. And then it was one of our Saturday projects as kids to have to go down and go through the tomatoes and the onions and sort for the bad ones and so on. But we would wrap each one individually in the newspaper and store them down on the basement floor for winter.
Yeah.
And you stored them right on the floor.
Yeah, we did.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's a little cooler.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you bring up a really good point, which is one that we make with anything that you're storing over winter, whether it's vegetable crops, even squashes, pumpkins, or if it's things like cannas or any of those kinds of things, that you need to periodically through the winter check those. Because if you have any that are bad or going bad, they will actually make the others go bad faster. Mm-hmm. That old saying, you know, the rotten apple spoils the barrel, is true, because they give off ethylene gas, which actually promotes ripening, or you can also read that as death, senescence.
Yeah.
So it is really important, first of all, when you store anything, that they're in really good shape to begin with, eat or can or whatever, something that's
and
damaged.
Dried, not
right,
moisture
right.
On them
exactly.
And so on.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, yep. Great ideas. Thanks.
Thanks, Laura. And Lyle in Sun Prairie. Hi.
Hi, I'm just out in the garden digging potatoes as we speak, and one of the things, usually every year I save Yukon Gold potatoes and replant them in the spring. Mm-hmm. They're usually viable for about 4 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yesterday I dug and replanted the portion of the harvest for elephant garlic, and I've had the same plot that's going on for about 12 or 15 years. And then every spring I have four different variety of raspberries, and my neighbors all come over for suckers, and we're able to take and propagate raspberries from suckers in the spring. So there's a lot of things you can do without actually going through the process of saving seed.
Yeah, and what's the crops you mentioned, actually, you can't very easily do by seed, so that's the main way you propagate. Potato seeds, really very rarely, if ever, you can save seeds from them effectively because there's so much cross-pollination, so you have to do it by that way, and that's called clonal propagation, and the same way with the garlic. So that's, yeah, that's fantastic.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Wonderful. Thank you very much for calling. Now I'm thinking back again to my single days when we had the guy I rented a house with. We had potatoes and we put them down in the basement, for winter storage, mm-hmm. and then we promptly forgot about them. And so in spring, it looked like something from a science fiction movie because all these eyes and these long white.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you're just going to have to plant those then.
Yeah. it was pretty cool looking, actually. Mm-hmm. We took some pretty neat photos of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
We have Marlis in Cambridge with a question. Hi, Marlis.
Hello. I had a question. I have Siberian irises, and they're a little bit narrower than the regular irises, and then daylilies. And of course, the flowers are all done. Their leaves are still pretty green, but these plants are laying flat on the ground as if they're dead. I wondered, is it too early to cut them off? Or because I cut them off every fall. If they're still green,
yeah.
Do I need to wait till they're all brown?
No, you don't have to at this point. If they're lopping over and look really ugly and you don't like them, go ahead and clean them up for the fall. It's fine. Most of it, usually, late August, September, and into October is when all of our perennial plants and our trees and shrubs pull down the carbohydrates that they produce down into their root system. And so if they're starting to lop over and we're basically at October now, they probably right. pulled down the majority of the carbohydrates into the root system. So you're probably pretty good in cutting them back.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm.
Thanks a lot for calling. Ours are our daylilies are still up and
awesome.
Green. I mean, not flowering, obviously, but the leaves are.
Yeah, mine still look okay, but.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. It depends on where you are and all sorts of things.
Yeah.
We are talking today with Barb Larson and Christy Marsden, who are horticulture educators with UW Extension. Barb is in Kenosha County. Christy's in Rock County. Larry Mueller here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at your fall garden today with Barb Larson and Christy Marsden from UW Extension. They're horticulture educators. Larry Mueller here. So great to have you along. Talking about seed saving techniques and talk about just fall cleanup and other things that are going on in the garden right now. And hope you'll join us at 800-642-1234. Those lines are actually filled right now, but you can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Or post on my Facebook page. To do that, just go to the Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. You can post right there. Peter in Lafarge, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello, I love your show. I have a question about pears, canning pears.
Yeah.
These are winter pears, and they're really, really hard.
Yeah.
How do you get those to soften, to ripen up so you can can them?
If I remember correctly, pears don't ripen very well once they're harvested.
Yeah.
So I you may be out of luck on this one.
Well, and I think of winter pears as being stored. Like the idea is you could put them in your root cellar and get them in the middle of winter and have a good pear. So maybe if you just wait a couple months, I don't know.
Yeah.
If you have a root cellar.
Yeah, I don't know for sure on this one.
Yeah.
Sorry, try it out and let us. Yeah.
Can you just make cider out of them?
The problem is when they're that hard, there's probably not a lot of
sugar in them. Yeah.
In them, and so you're not gonna, you probably aren't gonna get a very good cider out of it.
Yeah.
I'd let them wait. I'd wait.
Yeah, I mean you're not out anything if you wait.
Yeah.
See what happens.
Okay.
Yeah. Good luck.
Put them in something with an apple.
Yeah.
Call back in 2 months and let me know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Appreciate it. Marion O'Claire, hi.
Hi, I have a question just about saving tomatoes.
Yeah.
Now, I've heard over the years that if you take tomato vines at frost time and pull them out of the ground and keep the tomatoes on them and hang them upside down, that the tomatoes will even ripen on the vine.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
And that that'll preserve the tomatoes. But I never tried it, and I don't know if it works.
I've never tried it either, but I've heard it many times. It's been a few years since I've heard it.
Yeah, the same thing for me. I've heard it before, but I've never heard of anybody trying it, and I've never tried it. So
I've heard it on the show where people actually tried it and said, yeah,
that did
work.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got a spot where you can hang.
Sure.
Yeah. Then why not give it a try?
Do you think it would work for peppers?
I've never heard it mentioned for peppers. I've only heard it with tomatoes.
Yeah.
Okay.
But guess what? You got a plant?
Yeah.
You got the room? I put it up and set it up.
Yeah. We're back to try it out and then let Larry know. Yeah. And then he can tell us.
Well, that's fun about gardening.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll put it in the experimental department.
Yeah.
All right. Good. Thanks for calling, Mary. Allison in Rhinelander. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, I have a couple of questions. One is about saving not seed literally, but as you alluded to earlier, potatoes for next year.
Yeah.
I had some potatoes that I put in my compost pile because they were too far gone, and they sprouted and started making little tiny potatoes, and I'm wondering if those are big enough to plant next year, or do they need to be a certain size to have the energy reserves to successfully sprout next year?
How big are they? Like a marble, or?
Yeah, we've got a lot of marble-sized ones.
Yeah.
So some of the seed potatoes that I've planted have actually been that small. What you'll find is you might not have as vigorous plants as if your potato were bigger, but you can definitely try it out, and it should work.
Okay. And do you have time for a second question about beans?
Beans, sure.
Yes, I have this exotic variety of long purple Asian string beans, and I got them in a little late, and that doesn't help that I'm up in Rhinelander.
No.
The short season, and the first couple of flowers have turned into beans, but all of the successive flowers have just shriveled up. And I'm wondering if I missed my pollinator window, or are they selfing, and maybe it's some sort of disease problem?
I'm not really sure. I do know that beans in general are very sensitive to their environment. So if it's too hot or too cold, they may flower or they may not flower at all. So it could just be a timing issue. And one of the things to keep in mind when saving seed is to really know your environment. So if you have a particular variety, and this comes in mind, especially with bigger lima beans, you really need a long season that we just don't have in Wisconsin.
Are there male flowers with those beans?
No.
With the beans? Okay.
Green, beans are male and female in the same flower.
Yeah, and that's how they're selfers, because they all got it right there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so the flowers, I've got abundant flowers, but the original ones, you know, actually managed to be fertilized, but a lot of the others just shrivel up and don't actually
fertilize. And it may not be a fertilization issue. Mm-hmm. I agree with Christy. I think it's probably an environmental problem, and it could be you're getting probably pretty darn cool at night now. And so that could very well be some of the issue. Beans are like hot weather.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
okay.
So I think you're probably, it's probably just too cool for them to really start developing fruits.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So save those few and, you know, hopefully you can continue next year with them and start them earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go to Dubuque, Iowa. Barb, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yes. My pleasure to speak with you. Here's my issue. A couple of years ago, maybe three, my son built me six double 4x4 raised bed gardens. We used bagged vegetable garden soil in it. The next year, we added more of the same just because of settlement. Then last year, a garden center recommended that we add peat moss to it, which we did, and they said add about half of the volume. Well, now, as you can imagine, it's like pouring water through a colander. I can't keep it. I can't keep the garden moist. What do I add next to try and make it hold water, retain water?
Well, so are you keeping it moist? My concern is usually peat moss will hold a lot of moisture. And but if peat moss completely dries out, it actually is hydrophilic. It will shed water off of it. So the key, if you have a lot of peat moss in it, is to make sure you, not that you keep it drippy wet, but that you keep it kind of continually moist with it. Usually what I recommend for most of these things is using compost.
Yep.
And so you may want to refill with some compost instead in there and kind of convert that over. I love raised beds. I think they're the one of the best ways, especially in southern Wisconsin, northern Illinois, and I'm guessing in Iowa you're probably very similar, especially in urban areas where the soil may be a little hard. It really works well to go to raised beds, but they do dry out faster, and so you will find you are watering more. What we found with some of our community gardens, some people even put soaker hoses and incorporate those into the raised beds, and then they can just hook them up periodically and run it and keep the beds moist that way. It's a little less work that way.
Yeah, good idea, but 4 foot by 4 foot, you know, it's a little hard to put a soaker hose in.
No. These are big beds. Sometimes 4x8 or 4x12.
Yeah. Yep.
So.
Okay. All right. So basically compost would help me now.
You know,
like with all the water we had this spring, and then as it started to dry out, I started to water, but still it was still like going through a sieve.
I
hadn't had the issue prior to the peat moss.
Yeah, I'm thinking that peat moss got too dry and it's just shedding the water.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling, Barb. Claudia emailed us and wondered, how do you know when your acorn squash is ready to harvest? What do you think, Christy Marsden?
I think that, if I remember correctly, where the acorn squash touches the ground, that there will be a color change on that spot, I think, is one of the indicators. Usually for me, if the vine plant itself is kind of dying back and it's closing down, there's not...
The other thing to do on any of the winter squashes, and pumpkin is in this too, is the fingernail test.
Yeah,
right.
There it
so
is.
You put your fingernail, and if it's hard to press in with your fingernail, then it's probably ready to pick.
Yeah, that color thing I think is actually for melons.
Yeah.
Not squash.
Yeah. Whenever you harvest, especially if you want to store them, you don't want to just pull them off the vine. You may want to cut them off so that you keep a little bit of stem there, and they'll keep a lot better.
Actually, Trish had also emailed and wondered more about curing and storing acorn squash, and that's pretty much what you do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's no special, usually, treatment. You want to keep them in a cool, dry place. For some of us, that's pretty easy to do. Some people have cool basements that it works. And some people don't. I don't. I'm in a newer house, so it makes it a little more challenging to keep those. So, but you want to find that place that's going to keep them probably in that 40 to 45 degree temperature range. And as we mentioned earlier, make sure that they're good quality. So if there are dings or cuts or, you know, a bug's eaten it or something like that, those are the ones you want to go ahead and fix right away.
Yep.
What should we do? Well, here's Doris from Bondiwell. Wonders if there's any way she could propagate a new Mugo pine shrub from one that's very overgrown right now. She has one growing. And
Mugo pines are, especially the regular ones, would probably be seed propagated. I would have to look up to see if they require that cold, moist period, which is called stratification.
Yeah.
And usually if you do that, you put the seeds into a bag with peat moss and that's moist and then put it in the refrigerator for 3 or 4 months. Or you can just plant the seeds in the ground in the fall and then Mother Nature does it.
Could you do it clonally? Like if you cut off?
I'm sure you could also do. I think you could do cuttings too. So there are several good references out there on propagation. You can either call your extension office or you can look up other ways. And or if you're comfortable with the internet, you could even Google propagate Mugo pine.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think about Extension. Extension has so many great publications that's relating to gardening. That's unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know that we have some basic ones, but when you get into that specifics about propagating trees and that kind of thing, I don't think we have anything, but there are good references out there. Yeah, Michael Durr is a good one.
Really good one. We are talking today with Barb Larson, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Kenosha County, and also visiting with Christy Marsden. Christy, a horticulture educator for UW Extension in Rock County. She previously worked with Seed Savers Exchange in Decorah, Iowa. Extension does a great job. We have wonderful horticulture experts for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Having a healthy garden is a real treat, isn't it? The beautiful flowers we get, the delicious vegetables that we get, the herbs and the fruits to enjoy. Sometimes tending the garden, though, and spending time outside, it can be a little bit of work, but it's also great for your mental health as well as your physical health. Larry Mueller here. Welcome to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. We have a great group of horticulture educators with UW Extension who come by every so often, pretty often on Fridays, to talk with us about what's going on in the garden. Barb Larson with us today, horticulturist for UW Extension in Kenosha County. Thanks for coming by, Barb.
Appreciate I'm it. Happy to be here.
And welcoming Christy Marsden for the first time, hort educator with Rock County. Christy, thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
Really pleased to have you with us today. You can join in if you have a question for our guest. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org and post on my Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show. Love to see. I haven't seen a photo yet. I haven't had a good garden photo yet today. So if you got one of those, post it up on the Facebook page. Marilyn and Shiocton, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
I have had blight in on my tomatoes, and I moved my where I planted the tomatoes in my garden this year, thinking that that would do the trick, and I still have blight. And you know, all my leaves died, and my fruit doesn't stay, you know, keep very long. What can I do about that?
Yeah, blight. It sometimes will come in through the just on the wind, so there's not a lot you can do about it. One of the best things you can do for next year is to make sure that you take all plant matter related to that tomato, all the fruit, all the leaves, all the vines, and just destroy them, get rid of them. So then that way you don't have any inoculate for the next year for that blighted tomato. And that's the idea behind rotation, is that you're giving it a new spot that is less likely to have that blight inoculate on it, but sometimes.
Yeah. And without knowing which, sounds like you've got one of the fungal leaf diseases, without knowing which one, you can't tell you specifics. Mm-hmm. But we know in a backyard garden, it's really hard to rotate far enough to really get away from it.
Yeah.
So I always recommend that people, when you're growing tomatoes, that you use some sort of mulch around them so that you help prevent rain splash, because in case the fungal spores are in the soil, they'll splash with rain up onto the lower leaves, and sometimes that will spread it. I actually prefer stakes over cages, because by staking a tomato, it's a little more open to the air, and so you get better air movement through them, so the leaves dry out faster. You also, when you water, try to use soaker hoses instead of overhead watering, so that will help keep the leaves drier too. So there's several different cultural kinds of things things. And there are some plants that, some varieties that tend to be a little more resistant to some of the diseases than others are. So, but you could even, if you want, take a sample into your extension office and see if they can identify which kind of fungal leaf disease it is. And that could tell you a little bit more about what you might need to do for it. So,
do I take a piece of the plant?
Yeah, you want to take a leaf or a few leaves in. If they're completely brown, dead, dried up, we can't do autopsies on plants, so that's not going to help. So you want one that actually is showing the spotting or whatever you're seeing on it. So, it's kind of actively still working in there.
And a picture. Bring in pictures.
Yeah, pictures never hurt either.
Yep.
Okay. And does it... get on the, like, your hose and your tillers? Do I need to do anything with that?
Well, it kind of depends on what is the fungal cause, but, mm-hmm. It's always a good idea to do a good fall cleanup on that, too. So not only should you kind of clean your garden out, and especially if you have any disease plants, but also to clean off all your tools in fall before you store them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and what about like the fence? I've got a 3-foot fence around my garden.
Yeah, I'm not as worried about that.
No, yeah.
Okay, all right. Very good.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thanks for calling.
Bob in Galena, Illinois. Hi, thanks for calling.
Thank you. Very great show. I have raised hard-neck garlic for over 40 years and had great success with it. And this year, it seems like I found out that maybe we had yellow aster because the product when we harvested was very small. Like, some of it was a quarter size. Some of the, I never did get back to find any that was any that was as large as it was previous years.
So aster yellows, would that do
yeah,
it?
Yeah, and I'm assuming possibly the garlic heads themselves maybe had a purple tint to them, or some purple browning maybe.
Yes, it did last year. I noticed some of it. And this year, the whole crop was almost a failure because it was so small, and it was yellowish colored all summer long.
Yeah.
A lot of it didn't come up from our last year's fall planting.
Yeah, so you could have actually contracted that last year, and then when you replanted that same garlic, it got spread throughout the entire crop. I feel the best bet at this point is to start with new stock that's clean, because it seems like your garlic stock that you've been planting with may be diseased. And if you still want to go with what you have, make sure pick out the cleanest, healthiest looking ones and see if that changes it for next year.
Yeah. The problem with something like aster yellows, if that's what it is it's a phytoplasma, which means that you're not going to get rid of it. It's right in there. It's like a virus where you can't get rid of it.
Yeah.
So.
Is it in the soil?
No, it's in the plant.
Yeah, and it's actually spread by insects, so that's how it'll get from one plant to the next. So if you get rid of the contaminated garlic stock, you should be fine for the next year.
Yeah, so you're best off starting all over again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sometimes this happens.
That's what I did. I ordered some from a couple of states away where they don't have it, I don't think, and I thought I would try it. But I didn't know for sure it was in the soil or not.
No, not if that's what it is.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks, Bob. Thomas in Minocqua.
Hello, Larry. When you had a few people calling before telling how they were preserving things over winter,
mm-hmm.
it made my mind open up a little bit and remember the 40s. And my dad would always have a couple 10-gallon crocks in the garage, and they were half filled with pure lake sand from Lake Michigan.
Yeah.
Just clean, but dry, naturally. Real dry. And we dumped that out and put our carrots in the bottom, put a layer in, put some sand in, put the carrots in, put some sand in, till we had it all filled. They last for 4, 5, 6 months.
Yeah.
Right after 4 months or 5 months, when you're getting towards spring is coming on and you still got carrots out, you might have some quarter to a half inch little white fine hair, which is not real thick, but that's all that actually was active on the carrot. They're just delicious.
Where did you store them?
Well, you just left them in the garage, through winter.
Unheated garage.
No, it wasn't heated.
Yeah, that's what I mean, unheated, yeah.
Cool.
No, it's unheated. But it just, you didn't stack it so you didn't have much sand. I mean, you want to make sure you got a layer, then you got a good inch or two of sand, another layer, inch or two, because it's like a at least 50-50 situation with sand and carrots.
Yeah.
Yep.
Cool. It worked beautiful.
Yep. Yeah. Well, there's lots of things they used to have to do because they didn't have the availability of fresh fruits and vegetables year-round. Yeah. So, but,
yep. You know, the war was on, too.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Tom, thank you. Yeah, thank you very much for calling. That's another fun thing to try.
Yeah, sure. you got to get that clean lake sand, though. That might be a challenge.
Well, you want clean sand. Well, you could get clean sand now.
Yeah,
nowadays.
Yeah, you could.
Maybe not get
lake sand.
Might not get lake sand, but there's plenty of sand around you could get.
Yeah.
Thanks again. Appreciate it very much. We had Faye in Milwaukee with a question. I want to go to her. Faye, thanks for calling.
Okay, thank you for taking my call. I live on the east side of Milwaukee, and off of my bungalow on the second floor, I have a big deck, and I've grown tomatoes up there for the last 3-4 years. I've got 13 pots, and I do an Italian plum tomatoes, and I had tons of them this year. But I do have a little bit of the blossom end rot.
Yeah.
So that's am I right that it doesn't have enough calcium in the soil? So, or can I just treat that soil with calcium? And I read someplace where you could put eggshells in the spring when you plant and different things, or to prevent. I mean, it wasn't a lot, but there about half of those pots I've been consistently getting some rot on the bottom of the tomatoes. And the thing is, it's a lot of dirt to haul up the stairs. That's like a flight and a half to get it up. So I'm wondering, other than that, my tomatoes were delicious. I got just tons this year. Can I just amend that soil somewhat?
So are you using the same potting soil from year to year?
Well, actually, last fall, I added manure to every...
So you are still using the same potting soil from year to year.
Well, yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, you might want to mend it, but were you consistently watering them? Because sometimes you'll have blossom and rot show up when it's not consistent moisture levels getting up to the fruit of the plant.
Well, you know, I would water just about every day.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I did really good fertilization with an organic fertilizer that I diluted in the liquid. And so it was... it's not terrible. Like I said, I had so many tomatoes, I didn't know what to do with them. And they were good tasting, a lot of them. But what about the eggshells?
Let's back up just a little bit. So usually for most people, we talk about how the big problem with getting blossom end rot, and you're correct, is a calcium deficiency in the fruits. And it's because the calcium just doesn't move through the plant very well. And that's why you'll hear us recommend making sure that you keep it evenly moist, that it doesn't go through really dry to really wet back and forth, because the water flow through the plant doesn't work as well that way. Mm-hmm. However, in containers, sometimes what'll happen is that the calcium that's in that potting soil may become deficient. So especially if you're reusing year after year, even if you're adding things to it. So in that case, you may need to add calcium to it. I guess you could use something like eggshells, but the eggshells are going to have to decompose in order to release that calcium. So I don't think that's going to be kind of your, you know, go-to kind of thing. You may need to look at a fertilizer that contains calcium. And you mentioned that you used an organic fertilizer. So you may want to look at it and see if it has calcium in it. Mm-hmm. But still, even if you're putting it into the soil, you still got to keep that calcium's got to get out of the soil through the roots and out into the fruit. So you still have to have that regular flow. Mm-hmm. Some people even will use, and if you find that this is a continual problem, you might even want to look at using a calcium spray that you actually apply to the fruits themselves. But that's usually used for big growers and that kind of thing. I don't think if you're still getting good production, you're getting enough that you're eating enough tomatoes or having them for what you need, and you're just getting some that you're getting more blossom end rot on, I just, you know, throw those out and say, okay, this is what I typically get.
It's so, like less than 5%.
Yeah, then I wouldn't worry about it that much.
Yeah, that sounds pretty good.
Yeah, and so you may want to try different varieties because some cultivars are more prone to blossom end rot than others are.
Yeah, I've noticed that. I've noticed that too. So. Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. Sue and Rhinelander, hi.
Hi there. I am wondering about geraniums. I've got some gorgeous geraniums, and I'd like to save them for year to year. What's the best way to save them? What do you need to do to them, too?
Well, there's three different methods. So the first one is to bring them indoors, treat them like a houseplant. They will get really tall, leggy, ugly, but that's okay. All you have to do is keep them growing and alive through the wintertime. And then about in February sometime, you want to take stem cuttings or tip cuttings. And geraniums generally root really easily. You probably will have to use a rooting powder with them, but usually sometimes you don't even need that. So you may even want to try some without and some with it. And then you can root from there. Some people keep them inside, treat them as a house plant, and then cut back and are able to get them to come back out after they cut them back in February or early March. The other way I thought of when we had the tomatoes earlier, there are some people who have managed to keep geraniums year to year by pulling them out of the pot, shaking all the soil off of them, hanging them upside down in the basement and letting them go dormant, and then repotting them in that case, I would think you'd do it probably April or so, and then kicking them back into growth then. So you have three ways. If you have enough geraniums, try them, you know, two or three ways.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, thanks so much.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks, Sue. Carol in Sun Prairie. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have an answer to the gentleman with winter pears.
Okay.
I just finished canning some. They're a different animal from Bartlett's. They're a more firm pear. Don't wait until they turn yellow before you try and can them or they'll all be spoiled. Can them when they're a light green.
Okay.
And it'll be a firmer product.
Okay.
And some people like it much better than the soft one you get with Bartlett.
Okay, so...
And it usually takes 2 to 3 weeks after you pick them to get to that stage.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so 2 months is too long.
I harvested them and put them in crates, and then I stacked them on top of each other. Don't do that, because for some reason, the ones below the top crate will get ripe faster than the ones.
Well, that's because it goes
back. A single layer.
Yeah, it goes back to that apple in the barrel. So they produce enough ethylene, or if you have any other fruits around, that they'll start to ripen faster. Yep.
Right.
All right.
So, yep.
Good tips. Thanks, Carol.
Yeah.
Appreciate it very much. So maybe we saved some winter pears there. Let's go to Don in Menominee. Hi, Don.
Oh, hi. I have a question about butternut squash. This is the first year I have planted them. They've grown beautiful, but my question is, when do I know when they're ripe? I know they're not going to grow anymore this season, but what do I do? Just leave them out there? A number of them have green stripes on, and some of them look the full ivory color. I just don't know what to do.
Earlier someone called in with a very similar question, and so the answer is on the same lines, where you can go out there and grab your squash and put your fingernail in it, and if it gives really easily, it's not ready, and if it's hard, then it is ready to be harvested. And when you harvest it, make sure that you don't tear it off the vine, but that you cut it nice and cleanly, giving it at least an inch or two of some stalk left.
Yeah, and some of them you may find you want to leave on there until we get that frost. We actually like to usually harvest the winter squashes before we get a killing frost, a hard frost on them, because that will actually damage them and they won't store as well. So, but leave them out as long as you can for as many of them as to ripen as possible. But as Christy said, that fingernail test is probably the most accurate one.
Is it likely that a lot of them will not fully ripe this season?
Yeah, it might. It's been a hard year for some of those longer season crops just because we had such a late start with our spring being so wet and cool. And I'm kind of hearing that a lot within my county of just people having difficulty with their squashes not ripening in time. So that could happen, unfortunately, this year.
I do have another quick question.
Yeah.
I had zucchini squash planted nearby. Will they cross with the butternuts?
Well, that is a good question. And I'm not sure, because it's really important to know the actual species of both of those. There are four different species of squash that won't cross between each other, and I'm pretty sure, but don't trust me completely on this, but I'm pretty sure that zucchini and butternut are different species so that they won't cross.
That's good to hear.
All right.
Thank you for your help.
Thanks a lot for calling. And Jermaine emailed us, for the first time in 10 years, had a vegetable garden, see signs of what looks like maybe Japanese beetle damage on her green beans. Picked the few beans that were out there a couple of days ago. Several had a silvery kind of residue, almost like snail trails near holes that had been drilled into the beans. Want to do something, don't know what to do. That doesn't sound like Japanese beetle to me.
No, but there is a bean beetle. So it's possible that that's what it is. So you could go out and investigate. Yeah. And then next year, you know, my favorite way to keep bugs off of vegetable gardens is using floating row cover.
Yep.
And because you don't have to do sprays and that kind of thing. So next year you may want to think about that. Yeah. But if you find an insect, you again, take it into the extension officer, take a picture and take it in so they can help identify what may be going on.
Yeah.
And the floating row covers, I mean, they're cheap. It's really inexpensive.
Yeah, relatively inexpensive.
Yeah, and it's really effective.
Yeah, and if you mail order, you can get really big rolls for a reasonable price.
Bill in Lancaster, hi.
Hey, I just wanted to call in. I heard a guy last week say that honeysuckle or buckthorn doesn't spread. They absolutely do spread. I've got 90 acres of woods here in Lancaster.
Yeah.
They're just absolutely choked with buckthorn and honeysuckle.
Yeah, what we're not going to argue with you on that one.
What happens is birds eat the berries and they go off and they sit on a fence row or they sit in another tree, and that's where the spread comes from. You may not notice it in your yard, but that bird ate a berry in your yard and carried it to my woods.
Yeah. And we should mention that we're coming into the prime time to try to clean out those woody invasive plants, so honeysuckle and buckthorn. Fall is a great time to get rid of invasives because that's when the herbicides are most effective. Because if you do as the plant is pulling those carbohydrates back down into the root system, it'll also pull the herbicides down, and you'll get a much better kill or a much more effective kill.
And thanks a lot, Bill, for calling. Appreciate it. And Barb and Christy, thank you so much. Boy, the time flew, didn't it?
Yeah, thank you.
thank you so much.
We'll have you back and do it again.
Definitely.
Barb Larson, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Kenosha County, and Christy Marsden, UW Extension horticulture educator for Rock County. And they will be back again. We had a Facebook link to the Organic Seed Alliance page where you can download a seed-saving guide for gardeners and farmers publication. That's on my Facebook page, so I hope you'll go to that. Next Monday, Jennifer Cheverini, our New York Times best-selling Wisconsin author, joins us to talk about her latest book. And the weather guys make an appearance as well. Thanks for listening. Stay with us.